Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. Before we jump into an overview of today's episode, don't forget, our Adventure Grant is going right now. We're giving away $1,000 first place, second place $500, third place $250. If you're doing an adventure this year and you need some help with funding and gear, apply. I don't care if it's a week-long adventure, I don't care if it's overnight, I don't care if it's 11 months of the year. Apply. You never know. You might get it, and it might be what sparks you to get you the funding you need to actually go do it. The last time I'm going to tell you is on Monday because the application closes February 22nd. So don't wait, or if you know someone that's kind of on the fence about an adventure or definitely is doing something, have them apply. All right, today's episode is a throwback to 2018 when I talked to Alex Jablonski about being a wildland firefighter. Get this, he became a firefighter just so that he could film a documentary about what it was like to be a firefighter. So he went through all the certifications, he did all the training, him and his friend, and they filmed one fire crew throughout the season to experience the highs and lows, the uncertainty, the fear, the difficulty of fighting fire. It is obviously a huge problem, a growing problem. And that film, we talked right before it came out. It came out in January 2019, and it ended up winning two Emmys in 2019. It was Outstanding Cinematography and Outstanding Editing. And it was nominated, I think, for Best Nature Documentary as well, but didn't win. But still, nominated for three Emmys. It's absolutely worth your time. Check out the website for all the places you can, or check out the show notes for all the places that you can see it, because it's an amazing film, and I watched it back then. I'm probably going to rewatch it after this episode airs. But all right, let's go ahead and jump into today's episode. Hey everybody, welcome to the show. Today we have a pretty interesting guest. He's a filmmaker. He has produced a number of films, documentaries. A lot of his stuff has been featured with clients like Tesla, Solar City, Patagonia, the Army. He is a professor at USC School of Cinematic Arts and a certified wildland firefighter. Welcome to the show, Alex Jablonski.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, man. Where are you coming from today?
I live in Los Angeles. So,
you're a wildland firefighter. Why don't you, what is that about? Is that something you pursued before you got into film or during?
No, the reason I became a wildland firefighter was to make Wildland. So it was, when we began pursuing the project, one of the things we realized was that kind of getting both access and a certain amount of like credibility was going to be really critical. And one of the ways we thought to do that was to just get certified right off the bat. So we went through the training and passed the PAC test, and then we had what was called our red cards. And so we're certified before we even began making the film.
Wow, that's awesome, man. Because you know, I watched the film last night, actually, and by the way, it was fantastic. And that is what we're talking about today. Yeah, no worries. And I was thinking, like, holy crap, that camera is really close to that fire. I really hope that these filmmakers, like, knew what they were doing, because you are in some, you know, it's not CGI. It's precarious situations that you put yourself in. So I'm sure that was almost necessary.
Mm, absolutely. So. You know, to make the film, and so for folks who obviously, folks listening is probably haven't seen it, this film is about one wildland firefighting crew over the course of one summer. So you see these guys go from job interviews to training on through the entire fire season, and it kind of culminates in this big fight with a fire that's kind of broken out and escaped its containment lines. And so to make the film, we were actually members of the crew. So we weren't just, you know, kind of dropping in, parachuting in, and shooting for a couple of days and then being out. Like, we were on the crew. We were working as firefighters. And so we were only shooting probably 10 or 15% of the time that we were out there, and the rest of the time we were actually doing the work.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I mean, but that was, it was really necessary to get the kind of vibe of what that work and what that life is like and what those summers feel like. I mean, that was, it was a really critical part, I think, for us to just understand the kind of the headspace that you're in when you're out there.
How difficult was it to acquire that certification?
It's relatively easy, actually. I mean, okay. you have to do a pack test, which is that you have to, walk 3 miles in under 45 minutes while wearing a 45-pound weighted vest. And, you know, most people in fire will tell you that's going to be the easiest thing you're going to do all summer. And then it's 5 days of training, and that's pretty much it. You have to take tests along the way, you know, testing your fire knowledge, but that's pretty much what's required to just get your very base level wildland firefighter cert.
Huh. Do you think that comes from a need for more firefighters, or is that really basically the brunt of the work?
No, I think so. It's a very tiered system in the sense that certain crews for certain classifications have to have people who have multiple years of fire experience. Like the crew that I was on, which was a Type 2 IA, which stands for Initial Attack, I might get this wrong, but I believe that the requirement is that you have to have either 12 or 14 what's called seasoned firefighters, meaning guys who have more than 1 year in fire. So you're only carrying like 6 to 8 rookies at a time. So I think what it is like once you get in and you get hired, a lot of the training and the qualifications come on the job. So pretty much it's like get these guys in, they start working, and then you're learning so much, you know, fire after fire after fire. You're learning whether it's, you know, radio protocols or how to work with helicopters or why, you know, kind of strategic approaches and all that stuff. A lot of that stuff is just learned on the job.
So did you find it difficult to carry your equipment, your firefighting equipment, as well as your camera equipment?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely. So we shot this film primarily on the Red, which is a 6K camera. It's the same camera that like Lord of the Rings was shot on and probably a lot of your favorite commercials.
Yeah,
and
it was a beautifully, beautiful film, man.
Oh, thank you so much. So, that had some weight to it. And then, we also had to carry an extra battery and a lens, but we had a really stripped down, camera package. But in addition to that, you're carrying all of your water, you're carrying a hand tool, you're carrying, you know, your lunch, you're carrying some kind of like miscellaneous stuff. Like I always carried an extra pair of socks, an extra pair of sock liners, things like that. So all in all, you know, I was carrying probably 55 pounds at the start of the day. And as I drank my water, that would go down, but, you know, somewhere around 50 pounds. And in fire, for people who don't know, you're required to wear your pack at all times. You're required to wear your pack at all times and carry a hand tool at all times. So even when you're, you know, digging line in one section, you're not taking that pack off. So that was just an extra 55 pounds that you're wearing for 12 to 16 hours a day.
I noticed that everyone kept their packs on now that you mention it. Why is that? So you just don't become separated from basically gear to survive with?
Yeah, and also, you know, you're required to carry a fire shelter. These are these kind of space-age looking reflective, not blankets, but little shelters that in case of a burnover. And that, you know, typically sits on the bottom of your pack, strapped on the exterior, and you need to have that on you at all times. So that's a big reason why you're just never taking your pack off. So that you can always have that if there's the need to deploy.
Wow. You know, what an interesting idea. Did you know that you were going to acquire that certification when you started pursuing the idea of the film? Or was that something you realized you had to do later on?
It was just kind of like, well, what's the best way to earn some trust and to show that we're serious? And so when we began to meet with people initially about shooting the film, you know, one of the first things we would say is, well, we already have our red cards, we're already certified. And what that signified to the people across the table from us is, okay, these guys have already put in their own time and their own money to get certified, and they, you know, and like one of the guys that we were talking to, said, like, look, you guys are in good physical shape. I would hire you as firefighters. You seem smart. You seem like you want to work hard. And so knowing that, it's like you already have gotten a lot further than I think a lot of other filmmakers would have, who had they pursued it in a different direction.
Yeah, no kidding, man. I assume it was you and your partner, correct?
That yeah, were the only two? Khalil Hudson
yes.
is the director, yeah.
And so what was the dynamic with the two of you there? Did you, obviously you wanted to seem as natural as possible, but these are admittedly people that are not being filmed very often, probably.
Right.
And what was that like? Did you feel a part of the group, or did you feel somewhat isolated from them?
Well, it wasn't so black and white. It was more of a spectrum, and it was more of a journey. In the sense that when we started out, we were isolated. And it wasn't that we started out and it was like, boom, okay, we're on a fire and here we are. You know, the process, like anything, like any relationship, right? Like the process of earning trust was very much a process. So we began going up to Oregon, to Southern Oregon, which is where this crew is out of. They're out of Grants Pass in Southern Oregon. We began going up there, and first it was just meeting the guys who run the company and the base manager. And it was like hanging out for a day, no camera out, just talking and saying, hey, could we go and talk to these guys? And you know, we started this process in the spring of 2015. So it was during kind of coming off the winter season. And at that time, what these guys were doing is called project work, which is basically forestry work, where they're thinning forests, you know, stacking sticks. There are guys who are limbing trees, who are cutting small trees down, and then stack just big piles of sticks. And it's not particularly exciting work. It's hard. You're on steep ground and you're, you know, back off of old fire roads or logging roads. And the fact that we would be willing to trudge out there and just hang out for 12 hours with these guys, they started to see that we were serious about this. And then slowly, as we began to see, like, oh, this character would be good, or we'd like to follow this guy, we would start talking to him. But there was like a ton of resistance. Like, guys didn't want us around. They thought that we had some kind of ulterior motives, or they just weren't really sure what we were up to. And in the film, there's a crew boss who's the kind of quarterback or the head coach of the crew, and his name is Tim Brewer. And Tim he's got at this point 22 years in fire, and is just one of the smartest, sharpest crew bosses around, and is really well respected. But he's gruff. He's got a very sharp tongue, and he's a smart guy with a quick wit, and he can cut you down to size pretty fast. And the first time I approached him about being in this, I said, hey, Tim, you know, we were like passing each other at the base. And I said, hey, Tim, my name's Alex. You know, we're making this film. Do you know about that? And, you know, we're interested in talking to you about maybe following you or following your crew. And he just looked at me and he said, you know, I'm a dickhead. Right. And then he walked away from me, and he didn't speak to me for a week. And now Tim and I text all the time. We're buddies, you know, we're friends, and obviously we have a very different relationship now, but that took, you know, 2 years before we could get to that point. And one thing I would say is for folks who see the film, or folks who have a chance to watch it, you know, Tim reveals some really personal stuff about his own life in the film.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think and the role that fire has played in his own life. And I think that, you know, that's where a lot of the power of this film comes from. And that comes about simply by earning someone's trust.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. No, that's, man, there's just so much. The film was so interesting, and there were plenty of characters that you began to really enjoy following, wanted to learn more about. Personally, I was craving more of it by the time it ended. It was shorter mm-hmm. than I expected, which I, you know, producing a film is, I can't even imagine how much work. I've never done it, but
yeah,
it's like, man, I want to know more about this guy. Why is he doing this? Why is he out here? Was it frustrating for you not being able to focus on it all the time with like, you know, an 8-foot flame approaching you?
No, I mean, you know, I actually think that you saying like, oh, I wish it was longer is a great thing. You know, as a filmmaker, you always want people right. to leave wanting more. I honestly, like, it wasn't so much the fire as it was the exhaustion. Because, you know, like, you're really tired out there. And for folks who don't know, you know, you're sleeping in fire camp. So you're sleeping on the ground or you're sleeping in a tent, just depending on the day. And, you know, we would get back into camp, I would say typically 8, 9 o'clock at night, grab something to eat, get into your sleeping bag, and then you're up at 5 or 5:30, typically 5, I would say, and back out. And, you know, carrying these packs, you work 14 days in a row before you have 2 days off. And so day 8, 9, 10 comes and, you know, you're just sick of it. And the idea of in the midst of day 9 or 10, having a moment where you go, oh, it looks like they're having an interesting conversation over there, or that's an interesting shot. Let me get up, go grab, you know, pull the camera out of my bag and walk over there and kneel down and set up the shot or climb up to the top of this ridge for this shot. You just get exhausted. And it's really hard to make creative, interesting creative decisions when you're just tired. And that was something that I was just fighting against the whole time.
I can honestly believe that, because, you know, you're looking at everybody else and they're taking a break. They have no responsibilities, whereas you guys have an entirely separate goal and project going on. Yeah, that's really exhausting on top of doing the same amount of work.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I would just say is, so to limit our camera package, to make things smaller and as kind of a aesthetic, you know, just visual consideration, we shot the entire film on a single lens, a single prime lens, meaning a single focal length. And that was a 40 millimeter lens. So the result is that when you watch the film, it feels really experiential. It feels like you're just immersed in this. You're riding with the guys. You're around with them. You're always kind of the same distance from them. The other thing, though, is because we didn't have a wide angle lens, when we needed a wider shot, that just means you had to get up and walk further away or hike up to the top of this ridge to get this big wide shot. So like the limited gear that we were able to carry resulted in like having to do more work on foot to get the footage that we needed.
Which in turn leads to more exhaustion.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But there are tricks for overcoming that.
Right. I can imagine. Well, something that, you know, I live out west. I live in Denver, and okay. I used to live in Yosemite National Park, and we used to have fires all the time. And I was familiar with like the hotshot crews, and I was familiar with what they looked like, but I was never really familiar with the actual work they did. And watching your film really surprised me with kind of the day-to-day tasks of a crew. Did you find that surprising? Was it what you expected before you started doing research on it and actually experience it for yourself?
No, I mean, and I think hotshot crews are a little bit different, because hotshot crews are full of really experienced guys. Mm. And although, I mean, Tim's crew, his Type 2 initial attack crew, does assignments right next to hotshot crews. I've seen them get, you know, the exact same assignment. So there's a lot of overlap. But I think what you're probably referring to is like, you know, these guys do a lot of mopping up. They do some of the stuff. Yes. that's not just raw firefighting. And I kind of expected some of that once we started getting into it, because I'd heard from folks who'd been on shot crews and other things like, yeah, you know, it gets really tedious, or it gets, you know, there are days where it's just awful, monotonous and not fun. So I expected some of that. But yeah, I mean, there was an interesting mix. There's, you know, it depends on big fires. Sometimes you fight them a little bit differently, which means, you know, you're just kind of digging containment lines and stuff like that. I mean, I was expecting some of it, but it was still eye-opening just how much of kind of drudgery and hurry up and wait there was.
Yeah, it seemed like a lot of really monotonous tasks, to be honest.
Yeah.
Long hours. And I didn't see a whole lot of face masks in the smoke. Surprised me.
Yeah, you never wear them.
These guys are breathing in a campfire for like 8 hours. Like, well, that's got to be terrible for you.
Yeah, you definitely feel it.
No kidding.
It's bad. I don't know. I mean, every once in a while you would see on another crew, like someone who had a bandana, and everybody just made fun of that dude because like it's just not part of the culture. So
it's a cultural thing. It's not that it wouldn't be useful.
I think it would be useful for the 4 hours that everyone laughed at you and pointed at you, and then you would take it off.
Right. Yeah.
Until it became like mandated.
It's like my pride, lung cancer. I'll choose my pride.
Yeah.
And, you know, actually bringing that up, something that my wife and I, because we watched it together, found really funny was, you know, these guys would spend, you know, hours in the smoke, literally walk away from it to have a cigarette.
Yeah.
There were a ton of cigarettes in your film, man.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of smoking. That's on this crew in particular.
Wait, is there, I mean, you know, I just got to ask, is there like a different regard for cigarette butts or for ashes with a crew like that versus just your everyday smoker? Because, you know, some of those fires get started by just a cigarette.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're super, super careful about that. And I think, you know, I think that's like where you're not going to see smoking like that on a hotshot crew. I think that they're a little more buttoned up. But I think some of that, too, is also it's the kind of culture of where this crew comes from, of Grants Pass, Oregon, and just kind of also there's a kind of like fatalism to it, which is the way that you see a lot of smoking in the military or like with guys who are on combat deployments. It's just kind of like, well, you know what, like I'm going to be fine and I'll still out hike you and all this.
Hmm. Okay. So, you know, we've already kind of gotten into the film, but I want to back out a little bit and just ask you, why? Why did you decide to do this film?
That's a great question. So, you know, we had made a film previously about fly fishing. It was called Low and Clear. And that film was about two friends who go on a who basically they shared fly fishing. Fly fishing was the thing that they did that they loved together. They went their separate ways and they come back together for a reunion fishing trip to British Columbia. And over the course of that trip, their friendship completely falls apart because of the ways that they've changed. And the reason I'm saying, everybody check it out. And the reason I'm saying this is because that film was about the outdoors, ostensibly. It's like it's about fly fishing in some ways, but it was also about these much bigger kind of universal issues of like growing older, how friendships between guys change and shift, how your hobbies or your passions kind of bind you together, but they can also be the things that break you apart. And so for the next one, we were looking, you know, at least I was looking for something where it could be a story about the outdoors, but it could be about something much more universal and much bigger. And with wildland firefighting, I'd always had an interest in it. I'd always been fascinated by it. And I was also interested in this idea of like, how do young men grow up? Like how do you come of age? Like what are the things that need to change in you in order to kind of like become a man, for lack of a better term? And also how the work we do shapes us and how it shapes who we are. And so with those kind of ideas floating around and not kind of disconnected ideas of like, well, I think this is what I want the next film to be about. When we began to pull at the thread of wildland firefighting, we found that like, oh, this is the thing that connects all of this. Like, we can tell a story about how guys are shaped by the work they do. We can tell a story about how young guys come of age, and we can tell a story about the outdoors where, you know, in some ways the fire is like a metaphor for this kind of internal frustration that these young guys or angst are feeling. And so that was how it kind of all came together. And certain pieces of it we had, like, I knew what we wanted to do with it, and certain pieces of it were just total surprises.
Hmm. Okay. Do you feel like you, were able to address those issues?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's interesting because, you know, some of the biggest responses to the film are not about fire. They're about the kind of individual stories and the sense of like, seeing how this work does shape these guys and kind of how they carry themselves differently. You know, towards the end of the film, our old wise character, who's this former smoke jumper named Ed Float, who does all the training, he kind of encapsulates that in this quote of like, here's what you carry with you forever if you've become a firefighter. And that was really what we were after.
Did you see that change happen in some of those men? I mean, I think you did a good job portraying, especially the two friends, the young guys.
Yeah.
They were really very likable, and I enjoyed following their step. Could you see that as clearly as it came across on the film?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, as you're constructing it in editing, you know, you're definitely making choices that emphasize that, but yeah, I mean, I think those guys I saw being very different guys in September than they were in June. And I mean, they looked different physically in the sense that they had, you know, kind of gotten stronger and leaner and tougher, and they carried themselves differently. And, they particularly Aiden, this one character, he just, at the end of that season, he just had a totally different energy about him. And he ended up meeting a girl and having the confidence to just be like, look, I'm super into you. They're married now, you know, and he just, and they met right after fire season. And, you know, in my mind, I'm like, I don't know if he would have had the confidence to, approach this woman, in the same way that he did it had he not been in fire.
It was Aiden. And what was his friend?
Oh, Charlie.
It was that the red-haired one?
Yep, exactly.
I don't know if we can say all this. Tell me.
Oh, yeah, you can say all.
Okay. I feel like they grew apart.
Yeah, they do.
And maybe their level of success within the crew was very different to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's interesting. Like, what's your read on it? You felt like Aiden was more successful within the crew?
I felt like he made the most progress. I could just see his leadership. And I saw his friend, Charlie, you said?
Right.
Okay. I just totally slipped my mind again. I saw Charlie maybe draw back a little more, saying, oh yeah, this was awesome, but I don't know. I don't know where I want to go from here. He felt a little more directionless, and obviously retreated back home.
Right.
And that. And seeing the stark difference from the lifestyle he was living before to where his family's from, which was, you know, surprisingly nice.
Mm-hmm.
I felt for him. I felt like, oh man, come on, you got to keep going down this path. And I felt like Aiden knew that, and I wasn't necessarily worried about him. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's an interesting update.
Okay, yeah, because I don't know so, after that.
So Charlie went back to Wichita, and he spent a year in Wichita, living in Wichita, doing landscaping jobs, and then moved to Asheville. And he was still, I don't want to say haunted, but like fire and wildland fire was still calling to him. And he decided, like, you know what, that is the life for me. And he spent the last, you know, he spent the last year working in fire. And now he's just decided that that is his career. He's going to be a wildland firefighter. And so
it's awesome.
The same way in the end of the film, you see that he, you know, it's got a hold on him, whether he wants to acknowledge it or not, is what happened in his life.
That's incredible, man. And so, yeah, so I was going to ask about that as well. What are the seasons of these folks? You know, do they work a season then get to go back home? I know that wildfire kind of has its own season. But,
well, you know, because of a lot of things, the season's getting longer. It's kind of not ending. It's, you know, like right now, Tim's crew, the crew that is portrayed in the film, is on the campfire in California, the fire that just destroyed paradise. Yeah. So so this year they're going to miss Thanksgiving. And last year, that same crew was on the Thomas Fire, which was out here in Ventura, and the crew worked right up until Christmas Day. They came home Christmas Eve night. So, you know, the season, the fire seasons are getting much longer, where you have dispatches in November and December. But primarily there are some guys who work seasonally, meaning that a lot of guys will like either be done with college or be between, you know, their summer off, they're going and doing this. And then every crew has some full-time year-round employees. And when they are not, when they're out of fire season, they're doing the project work, which is thinning forests. And then Grayback in particular does a lot of prescribed burns. So in the spring, they'll do a lot of putting fire on the ground and burning to clean up forests as a way of fire prevention.
Man, that's a tough life.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that? Could you see yourself doing more of it? Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. I absolutely fell in love with it.
Really?
And you know, there's a very good chance that I'll go back out next summer without a camera just to work. Just because I miss it. And I think like the thing too is the same way that these guys were changed by the work, I was changed by the work. You know, there's no way. I don't think that there are very many people who could do that. And you could catch a fire, you dig line, you get the fire to lie down, you've got helicopters and planes supporting you, you're hiking out for an hour and a half, everybody's exhausted, you're looking at each other, you know, encouraging each other, encouraging guys you don't even like. You're like, I do not like that dude, but you look at me like, come on, you can do this, let's go. And that level of camaraderie, I don't think there's anybody who could do it and not be changed by it in some way, either large or small.
Interesting. So is it something that you would encourage people to try if they don't know what, you know, maybe to do?
Yeah. I mean, I think that if you're young and if you're strong and if you love the outdoors and if you've got, if you think of yourself as tough, or you think of yourself as having some grit, then absolutely you should do it. And if those are the things that you're looking for, if you're looking to be tested, if you're looking to develop some inner strength, I think that it's a great, great thing. You know, because I mean, it's like anything else. Like, well, I mean, not like anything else, but it's like any other challenge, which is there are moments where you think, God, I'm so tired. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know how I'm going to get through, you know, the next hour. And you have to find a way. And once you're able to find a way, you can look back and say, well, I made it through that. So now I can make it through this. I mean, I really think that those are the kind of building blocks of a certain kind of personal resilience.
So has that level of resilience changed the way that you produce film now?
It's made the... I mean, that's a really good question. It's made the moments of uncertainty and moments of like, I don't know what's going to happen with this project, it's made them much more tolerable, you know, because you're just like, you're just like, I can get through this. I can get through this. Like, I know, you know that the answer is not to sit there and get stuck in your own thoughts. The answer is to put it into action and to work. And when you do that, you know, good things happen. So, yeah, I think it's definitely just, I mean, it's just changed the way that I operate on a daily basis, I'd say.
Interesting. Yeah, I've actually heard a lot about grit lately and how much is lacking in today's culture. Mm-hmm. I guess I maybe wasn't aware of that, but talked to on the phone with the president of a university the other day, and he was saying he could just seize it year after year. Certain things grow in people, but grit is not one of them with each passing generation. So I think you're right. I think that's an invaluable quality. And if you can have it in today's world, I think it does set you apart a little bit. And there is no place you're going to learn it better than fighting fires. So from your experience with the crew and with kind of, I mean, you fought a classic California wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the system that's in place to fight those fires? Do you see it as efficient? Did you see any big gaps, or do you say, wow, these people are doing a fantastic job?
I mean, so I should just say, like, despite having made this film, being in fire, like, I'm very much like still, not an expert by any stretch.
Right.
I know more than probably the average person. Right. And I would say this, so different fires are fought differently, and different groups, whether it's Cal Fire or ODF or the Forest Service, I think fight fires differently. And I think that because fire behavior is changing so dramatically, and like, it's not in the film, but I firmly believe, you know, man-made climate change is dramatically increasing the way that increasing fire behavior and the extremities of fire behavior. And we saw that in the campfire. We saw that on the Woolsey fire just in the last month. And so I think that the way that we fight fires is going to have to change. And I think that one of the things that's happening is, there used to be a kind of, at times, a philosophy of like, let it burn. Like, okay, let's just kind of keep an eye on this fire and not let it get away from us. But those approaches have been kind of becoming more problematic. And a perfect example is in 2017, the Chetco bar fire in Oregon. At a certain point, it was like half an acre, and it was just kind of skunking around and smoldering on the floors. It wasn't getting into the trees, and they kind of like sought containment of it. And then at a certain point, and this is like after, I would say, like a month maybe or 3 weeks, it just blew up, and then it was threatening towns and all of this stuff. So I think that there's going to have to be a different approach in both how we manage forests, which is not to say logging them, but to say taking care of the understory, taking care of a lot of the stuff that accumulates on the ground. And then the way that we fight fires I don't know what that's going to be. Is it going to be, you know, different lines of containment, multiple lines of containment? Is it going to be a much stronger initial attack where, you know, the second that something's half an acre, it's like, get it out? But I do think that there's going to have to be a really big shift.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. Yeah, it's definitely challenging because that is definitely the mindset in a lot of places, maybe that have the luxury of being a little more humid or a little more lush. Letting mm-hmm. a fire burn is obviously, it's healthy for the forest, but you can also not allow that underbrush to get too big, because if a fire right. does, you know, it's, they suppress fires for years and years and years. And now they can't. But now, with the climate drying out in these hotter places that are getting warmer year after year, You just simply cannot do that. It'll wreak absolute havoc for millions and millions of people. And looking at how big of a problem it is, I noticed in your film that the tactics to fight them are still so, because it's needed, and this is not at fault of the services in place, but like it's so rudimentary. Like, wow, they are literally digging a line with like shovels and picks for this thing that like it's a fire, but it doesn't look that intimidating when you're looking at just one little line of it. You got to remember that flame is like extended half a mile in either direction, burning its way, right, which could just get out of hand at any second. It's just such a, it's almost like a cancer. It's so complex to solve, and the tactics in place are so, when you see it on the film, it really put it in perspective for me. Like, wow, that's literally what it is. It's literally fighting it like you would a rabid animal. You know what I mean? Like, I just didn't know that.
And also, I think you see in the film too, that like flame lengths that are 1 to 2 feet, 3 feet,
yeah,
you know, which seem very manageable. Mm-hmm. Like very quickly they're in the trees and all of a sudden it's roaring and you're like, oh, that, okay, now this is big and like, now we have to knock it down and all of this stuff. So, you know, the way that fire is, it changes just over the course of a day. You know, a certain section of a fire will change over the course of a day. But what I was going to say is, you know, fire is good for a forest when it's a certain type of fire, right? Which is meaning like when it is burning on the ground. What we just saw out here, yeah, in the Wolves Fire, where it burned 88% of the Santa Monica National Mountain, National Recreation Area, it's like that area is just moonscape now. And it's not going to come back for 30 years. And I think that with that, with fire in the landscape, like we have to keep it as healthy fire. And I actually think, you know, that's what prescribed burns do so well, is they clean up the forest, they stay on the ground, they get rid of that underbrush. And I think that if we had a giant, you know, a budget, which we probably need to do this, that would probably help forests a lot. Is to just, whether it's prescribed burns or project work where you're just getting all that stuff out and removing as much fuel. Because ultimately that's how you stop a fire, right? Is you have to either remove fuel, whether that's by digging a line or putting in dozer lines or whatever. So the more that we could do that outside of fire season, I think the better off we'd be.
Hmm. So it's fought before it's ever started.
In some ways, I mean, I've also heard people talking about that certain mountain towns should basically just build a moat of defensible space around them, you know, just like, yeah, big dozer lines and just like, you know, clear out a lot of that so that there's a fire break, you know, before it gets too close.
And also, you know, I realize that for you guys, you know, you're up on this hillside. It's just a little fire line, you know, a flame that's a couple feet off the ground, which does not seem that intimidating. But like, what do you don't have a lake full of water right there. So I can see water's heavy and it's hard to move.
Right.
And so are some of these other retardant substances. And yeah, it seems so, I watched it and think, wow, that seems so helpless for them right now. Like, because this thing is so out, it can get so out of control, and all you have is this pick and the shovel, and there's really, and that is honestly the best thing to do. You know what I mean? Like it's yep, really puts into perspective why fires are so dangerous and volatile. And yeah, I just think the film did a fantastic job.
Mm, thank you.
Yeah. And so you obviously, you know, you've been talking about it during this interview, and I can just tell in your voice, you're obviously extremely passionate about this now. Where do you think this newfound passion for firefighting is going to take your filmmaking?
I don't think I'm going to make another film about fire, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think that, just in looking at the careers of people that I admire, it's not necessarily, you know, I don't like want to be the person who's like, this is my beat and I'm only going to make this stuff about that. I mean, I think that if there's an opportunity, which there probably will be, to tell other stories about fire, I'll be happy to do that and interested in doing that and looking at a bigger scope. But to me, I mean, I think that what I'm interested in is documentaries that are not about like a hot button topic. You know what I mean? Where it's like a call to action, social issue documentary, you know, which is, it's just never been my interest. I think to me, documentaries are much more interesting when they're open-hearted and they are about the human experience in a really big way. And they combine this feeling of being epic and being intimate. And so that's what I'm after. And those are the stories that I'm after, you know, and for me, like every film starts with a question, and it starts with like for this film, it was how do young men grow up? You know, for other films, it was like, well, what happens to people who are labeled with potential? You know, like just stuff like that. And so I think that for me, it's like just trusting the process of like, okay, if I ask the right question and find the right subject, I'll be able to make a good film. And so that's kind of what I'm taking from this and moving forward and trying to take all of the grit and the hard work that went into this and know that no matter how tough the next project gets, having this one in the rearview mirror will give me the strength to just kind of keep pushing. Hmm.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily the subject, but it's the principles you've learned through it. And, you know, not saying inspiration won't come from maybe one of the storylines or something you discovered while filming this. And I appreciate you staying away from, you know, hot button topics, but ironically, fire is kind of a hot button topic right now.
It is, but I think that it's like, it'd be different if we were like, and there are films like this, right, where it's like, look at what's happening. Like we need to, you know, this is about this and it's about this like social issue thing. And it's always talking head.
So it's like a call to action, basically.
Yeah. Like a call to action, like really didactic and stuff like that. Like, fire is a hot button issue. And the reason a big part of wanting to make this film too, is that in my experience, and this was particularly true before, the Granite Mountain Hotshots tragedy in Yarnell, we never heard about the people who fight these fires. You never hear about wildland fires. And I remember when the three firefighters died in Twisp, Washington, which was 2015, the New York Times had their deaths on the front page for like of their website for like an hour. And that was it. And, you know, there was a part of me that was like the only time that we hear about wildland firefighters is when there's a tragedy. And there's a kind of general lack, I think, of appreciation or understanding that these are regular folks who are willing to do this stuff, both for their own reasons, but also out of a desire to be of service to others. And no matter what socioeconomic background they come from, no matter what's in their past, you know, particularly for the guys in our film, like they really deserve a lot of respect and love. And so I think that, you know, one of the hopes with this film, it's like, yeah, we're touching on a hot button topic, but my hope is that you watch this film and you're never going to hear a story on the radio or see something on the news about a fire, about a wildfire, without for at least a moment thinking about the people who are fighting it.
Yeah. And I appreciated the film coming from that angle. Those kinds of stories are always incredibly interesting to know who's behind it.
Yeah, let me just say one thing. So if people are interested in this film, we're doing a theatrical release of the film in January. And the way that it works is if you go to our website, which is wildlandfilm.com, you can see if there's a screening taking place in your area and reserve a ticket, or you can sign up to host a screening at a local movie theater. And it doesn't cost any money to host a screening. And a portion of the money that comes into the film is going to go to the Wildland Firefighter Foundation, which supports wildland firefighters who've been killed or injured in the line of duty. And then also we're going to do, we're going to donate a bunch of money to the California Wildfire Foundation, which helps the victims of the wildfires that we just had out here. So the website, one more time, is wildlandfilm.com. And that's where people can find, they can sign up for updates, they can find where the film's playing, or they can bring a screening to their town or city.
And so those screenings are also going to coincide with the release of the film theatrically?
That is how we're releasing the film.
Okay.
We're releasing it in this limited theatrical way where there's going to be dotted screenings throughout the country. And so you just go to our website and you'll see when there's a screening happening near you, or you can just bring a screening to you.
Yeah. Is there any parting, perspective or advice or something you want to share about the film or about yourself before we're done?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I hope that people enjoy it, you know, and I hope that people get something from it. I mean, I firmly believe that if you believe in the power of work to shape you, and if you have an interest in the outdoors, this film is really worth your time, and you'll get something from it. So seek it out, find it, bring it to you, and help us raise money for these folks.
Awesome. Yeah, and I totally give it my full endorsement. I absolutely loved it. It's beautifully shot.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, man. Take care.
Yeah. Have a good one. First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.